Tervetuloa taas Kitarapodin pariin. Tällä kertaa meillä on erityisluontoinen jakso, kun meillä on haastateltavana Owen Barry. Tämä haastattelu toteutettiin vuonna 2022 siinä alkusyksystä, jolloin oli just tullut tieto, että Owen on valittu The Chicksin uudeksi kiertuekitaristiksi. Lyhyesti Owenista. Owen on loistava englantilaislähtöinen kitaristi, joka on sitten bändinsä kanssa aikanaan muuttanut Yhdysvaltoihin ja Losiin ja sieltä päätynyt sitten nykyisimmin Nashvilleen. Varmaan ne kaikista tunnetuimmat keikat, mitä hänellä on ollut, on just tämä nykyinen The Chicks. Chicksin rundikitaristin rooli, jonka lisäksi hän on sitten soittanut Tal Wilkenfeldin bändissä ja täällä muistetaan tietysti Jeff Beckin basistina. Mainittakoon vielä, että tämä on Kitarapodin ensimmäinen yhteistyöjakso. Tämä jakso tuodaan teille yhteistyössä Musamaailman ja Saito Guitarsin kanssa. Tämä on siitäkin oikein kurantti tilanne, että Owen teki tämän tammikuun NAMM-messuilla diilin kyseisen japanilaisen kitaravalmistajan kanssa. Ja Saitohan valmistaa tällaisia todella laadukkaita käsityöinstrumentteja Japanissa omalla tehtaallaan. Ja käykää tsekkaamassa Saito Kitarat Musamaailman sivuilta. Pitemmittä puhetta, tässä Kitarapodi Owen Barryn kanssa.
Was that the movie Crossroads?
Yeah.
And you know, and I heard like Ry Cooder's like monster slide playing, and I heard Steve Vai shredding, and that kind of sparked my interest. But I'd always kind of, you know, I'd been around sort of like blues music growing up, and so obviously Stevie Ray Vaughan was an early influence for me. And I actually had tickets to go and see him in the UK, and then he, you know, he passed away about a month before I got to see him. Sucked. Yeah. So anyway, one of my first guitars was this Stevie Ray Vaughan sort of like, you know, very cheap parts caster, you know, put together, built for me. And you know, kind of the reason I started playing guitar was basically because I wasn't really a massive fan of music or guitar players, especially. It was just like, it was just something that I found it. And it was like I always say it's like a Rubik's cube that I could never solve. It wasn't because I wanted to make music. I didn't even kind of think about it that way until way later on, but it was just this thing I could just sit down with, just muck around with. And it would just like, you know, consume the, you know, hours and hours of my time just noodling around on this thing. And then, you know, I'd hear, you know, Eruption, and I'd be like, wow, I wonder how I do that, and try and figure that stuff out. And, you know, so from an early age, I was into, you know, Stevie Ray Vaughan, Albert King, you know, Ry Cooder influence. But then I was also, you know, fascinated by the technical side of stuff as well, stuff that, you know, arguably not musical. Because as I say, it wasn't, you know, music wasn't really my motivation for why I started. It was kind of to ease the boredom. So yeah, so from early on, I had this, you know, fascination with the technical side of playing, the technical players, and sort of like the bluesy sort of feel players. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I guess when I was about sort of 12 or 13, I started going to my local blues jams. Which is where I first heard Guthrie Govan playing guitar. He would have been about 18 or 19 and still working at McDonald's at that time. Yeah. And a bunch of the guys from Guitarist magazine would also go to the jam.
Oh, yeah.
So kind of going there and getting to play loud from an early age is like kind of what, you know, I don't know. I think there's just something about when you plug in into an amp and play really loud with a band, that kind of ignites something where you're like, you know, that you just don't get from, you know, playing in your bedroom into your little practice amp.
Yeah, indeed.
And it's a whole different thing. You know, it's, you know, when you're loud, it's like controlling the beast, the guitar, and sort of,
yeah.
And things like tone become a lot more. When you, you know, I was going to those jams and I was listening to sort of guys like Neville Martin and a guy called Len Tuckey, who used to play in the Suzy Quattro band, sort of older guys who'd been doing it for years. Mm-hmm. And just, you know, they just had their tone and it was just there. And so from early on, the tone thing was very important to me.
Yeah.
and you know, going to these jams every week, different backline, different gear every week, and just trying to tweak it and dial it. From an early age, I could always get a sound, a good sound, before I could really even had sort of much language in my playing. Mm. I always had good tones.
I have to ask now.
Yeah.
When it comes to mind, what do you consider to be the factor in having good tone? We're going straight into the deep end.
100%, it's all in your ears.
Yeah.
Because it's like, it's, you know, people say it's all in your hands, but the fact is, well, for a start, you have to actually have your own idea of what good tone is. If you don't, you have to know what you like, because otherwise you're just in the dark. So
exactly,
everyone has their own idea, I think, of what a good tone is. And that's why the guys who know how to use gear and know how to get the most out of gear, they always end up sounding the same, because they hone whatever gear they're using to get it as close to that sound in their head as you can get with that gear.
So
everything kind of ends up sort of, honing towards that sort of desired frequency spectrum that individual likes. But, you know, if you don't even have an idea of what you want, then forget it. Do you know what I mean? It's like, you know, it's like going in.
And it's still like, you can be a good player and not have good tone.
Yeah.
Like technique and having an idea of what you want to be and what to sound like and what's an ideal.
Yeah.
They are two separate things.
Good tone is more important to me than good technique and good language chops. Good tone is everything, you know? Good tone is, you know, is massive.
But then again, do you consider that good tone means having also the context and knowing when to use the tone? Because, you know, there might be songs that require really shrill and trebly guitar parts that might be not the most pleasant by themselves.
That's kind of a different rabbit hole. That's, you're kind of getting into the sort of session man, side man sort of thing there. But I think most guys that are sort of like, you know, are the guitarist in their own band, and it's, you know, they do their thing, and that's it. But as a side man or a session, you know, studio guy, somewhere that you might get asked to sound like, you know, something that's undesirable or you know.
Yeah.
So to sort of have your own identity, you have to have good ears to be able to dial it into what you like. Yeah. But then there's the whole thing of having good ears to know how to dial it into this thing, that thing. You know, if someone wants something that's like lo-fi, or someone wants something that's kind of, you know, even just as simple as, you know, someone wants something that's kind of, you know, country-ish, you know, like a even knowing how to get like the telly twang sort of sound, you know. If you don't do that, and that's not part of, you know, what you do, if you're in your own band, or you're, you know, if that's not part of your repertoire, then you might not have any idea how to do it, you know. And it's kind of almost like, good tone is like having really good ingredients with cooking. Like if you have a really good cut of beef or whatever, you don't have to have amazing cooking technique to for it to still be good. Or you don't have to have an amazing knowledge of, like, you know, herbs and spices and all that. If the basic foundation, the tone, is good, then you're kind of halfway there, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously it helps to be able to actually play notes, and, you know. A lot of it is just knowing what you want.
Yeah.
Because until you know what you want and what you like, then you're just twisting the knobs, and, you know. And that's the other thing, is people are scared to turn the knobs to where they, you know, feel they shouldn't be, you know. It's like dial with your ears and not your eyes and all that.
So let's go back to your back.
But my point is, tone. You know, everyone says tone is in the hands. Your hands definitely do manipulate the tone, But unless you can hear it and hear the difference that what you have, those manipulations are doing, then it doesn't matter. It's, it's all in the ears.
Exactly. Yeah. So going back to the moment that you're starting to have a good tone and playing and seeing Guthrie and all the guys at the jams.
Yeah.
Where do we go from there?
It goes to me going home in the car crying every week after watching Guthrie playing, probably. like, because, you know, even back then, I'd only been playing a few years, but I, you know, I knew what these guys like Steve Vai, Satriani, I knew what they could, you know, I could, even though I couldn't play that stuff, you know, as well as those guys, and obviously still can't, I could comprehend what they were doing and how they were doing it. Whereas this guy who was just down my pub, I was just like, even then I could understand that he was another level of, you know, of just, it was like, I was like, well, it just set the bar very high for me. And I would go home kind of deflated, but then I would, you know, come back and, you know, every week and, you know, and I wasn't, you know, he was very much doing the sort of shreddy sort of Vai thing back then. And it, you know, which wasn't necessarily all that sort of much of a popular move at the blues jam, but it was amazing and entertaining nonetheless. And I was, you know, I was down there just playing blues standards every week and doing my thing. But so, yeah, I kind of went down the SRV rabbit hole and I kind of then kind of played in Texas blues bands, sort of doing, you know, Stevie Ray and, you know, Fabulous Thunderbirds stuff and, you know, all sorts of other sort of Texas influenced music. And I actually would then, I opened for a lot of touring American bands when they came to the UK. Like I opened for the Thunderbirds and like Duke Robillard and like Clarence Gatemouth Brown and some pretty cool blues guys. But at the same time, I was, you know, I was kind of listening to like, you know, Pantera and stuff like that. So even, you know, it was more that I ended up, I did like the blues guitar, blues guitar music, but it was also that was the only vehicle I had to go out and play live was playing this blues stuff. I wasn't in any other sort of band or anything like that. But then, you know, I got into my sort of early, you know, into my sort of teens and started my own originals bands with my brothers and, you know, my brother and my, you know, skateboarding mates, and we were kind of, you know, skater punk rock sort of, you know, music. And it was, you know, it was pretty cool. We, you know, wrote some good stuff. And then, yeah, I guess then around sort of like 15, I entered the Guitarist magazine Young Guitarist of the Year competition. And, you know, by then I'd been going to these blues jams for a few years. And, you know, I was a confident player just because, you know, I'd been around with these older cats and, you know, had, like I say, had decent tone and, you know, was doing my thing and I was strong at what I was doing, or albeit fairly, you know, limited, you know, in terms of vocab and sort of styles, stylistically, you know, compared to what I can do now. But yeah, I entered this Guitarist magazine competition and I was like, well, you know, the only way I'm going to have any chance of doing this sort of thing, and this was kind of, you know, mid-90s, was like, it has to be like a Satriani style, you know, shred fest. So I wrote this piece called The Mutt's Nuts and sent it in, submitted it, and got through to the finals of this competition, where, which was at the Wembley, you know, guitar show in London. They had like the live finals there, you know, got up, did my thing with the backing tracks, won the competition. You had the, you know, had the article in the magazine, got a string deal and all that stuff. And yeah, it was great. And then, you know, just kind of went back to skateboarding and playing Texas blues for a bit, you know, as you do, you know, and it, you know, and even at that point, it was still just kind of one of my hobbies. It wasn't something that I was like, I really want to do this for a living, or, you know, I love playing guitar, because I didn't, I enjoyed it. But, you know, I like playing like billiards and, you know, snooker and, you know, and I was big into skateboarding and, you know, and other hobbies. And so, yeah, but I was just much better at the guitar than I was those other things. And I, you know, through winning the magazine, competition, I actually then got asked to join this kind of like rap metal band based up in London called Rush Cartel. And that was kind of like during, you know, the era where, you know, Limp Bizkit were like really like blowing up and all that stuff. And, you know, I somehow, you know, I started working with these producers up in London on that. And then as a byproduct of that, they were then asking me to sort of like play on other sessions and stuff for them. So then I got into the whole kind of like boy band sessions, playing on like demos for boy band stuff. So that was kind of my gateway into sort of doing the Sideman thing. And I was 17, 18, or whatever it would have been around then, earning money doing it and thinking, well, this is pretty cool.
Yeah.
This is better than, you know, because, you know, I had no interest in any further education.
Yeah.
And kind of those early sort of sessions kind of were an eye opener to me as to how limited my music theory was. Like I, you know, had no idea what I was playing, and, you know, so I had to learn certain things very quickly doing sessions. And then, I did that for a while. We're still, you know what? It's all so long ago. It's hard to try and remember what I was doing. I was still at that point. Yeah. And of course, you know, around sort of 16, 17, I discovered Jeff Beck, and that changed everything for me. That was kind of like the big turning point that just saved me from becoming a annoying Stevie Ray Vaughan kid, you know, because the world doesn't need another Stevie Ray Vaughan kid. Do you know what I mean? And at that point I'd kind of discovered like Robin Ford and Larry Carlton and those guys, and I was like, okay, there are other ways of playing the blues, and there is another way I can escape, you know, not an escape, but it was kind of like, you know, playing the pubs, doing like scuttlebutt in, you know, it's just like you become the sort of the you know, the seal balancing a ball on his nose.
Because I just started thinking about Joe Bonamassa, speaking of the same thing when he was young, and he was like the child prodigy and it's all special when you're just a kid, but when you're 18 and start to growing up and become an adult, so that's when you become like that interesting anymore compared to
it's like a circus act and not a very good one. It's like those guys that draw like caricatures in the park for money. It's like, wow, this guy's such an amazing artist, wow, that's so good, but then you realize he's drawn that same picture 100 times the same day and he can't and you ask him to just draw like an apple, and it's just like, well, you know what I mean? It's like but the trouble with that is then, of course, you know, becoming an annoying SRV kid or a clone of anyone else is the fast track to getting loads of praise and people telling you you're great. Do you know what I mean?
Well,
if I stop doing this and I actually try and find some sort of identity, then people might stop telling me I'm great. And, you know, and then at that point you assess, why am I really doing this? What do I actually want to get out of playing guitar? And does it actually have anything to do with music, or does it have to do with me like regurgitating what someone else did? And just to get a quick, you know, well, you're great, you know, can I have your pick sort of thing? Like,
and that's when,
Jeff and the answer Beck is no, there's no gratification in that. And then, you know, I discovered Jeff Beck and all these, you know, and, you know, arguably I kind of went down that rabbit hole a bit too much and sort of, you know, like to get into a bit too much of the, you know, so, you know, the Beckisms.
Now might be the perfect time to talk about Jeff Beck, as you are, you know, Jeff.
Right. Well, you know what? When I kind of then got into my 20s, I ended up playing in this band called Purple Melon. And the lead singer's dad was very good friends with Jeff. And the singer and I, we were getting together one weekend to do some writing for the band, and he said, oh yeah, my dad's getting, he's having a small, you know, he's getting remarried to his girlfriend this weekend, and he's having a you know, just a ceremony down in, you know, just at his house down in the countryside, which by the way was like a castle with a moat around it. his dad wrote a bunch of like massive like Celine Dion hits and all this stuff. So anyway, we go down to the countryside, and I'm staying at the house with Tom the singer, and you know, the next day a few guests start to arrive, and I notice this black Corvette outside, and I'm like, oh, that's a bit unusual in England. Then I go into the kitchen, and all of a sudden Jeff Beck stand there, you know, stood in there, you know, my favorite guitar player, you know, my number one guy at that time. And and I ended up just, you know, getting to sort of spend the whole weekend with him, hanging out. And it was actually my friend's dad's birthday that weekend as well.
Yeah.
And we were just kind of like noodling around, and my friend's dad came in the room, and Jeff was like, hey, can I borrow that guitar? And he grabs my Strat, which back then was like my own attempt at building a Lake Placid Blue Relic. Actually the body was finished by a guy called Clive Brown, who's like recognized as the master of, you know, Relic stuff in the UK. Yeah. And Jeff grabs his Strat just into, I don't know, some crappy amp. And then he says, hey, this is for you, Andy. And then he plays the Somewhere Over the Rainbow thing, which I'm sure you've heard him play. Yeah, and that was the first time I'd ever seen him do it. So he'd obviously only just, you know, worked on it sort of recently,
yeah,
you know, and it was about, you know, from me to the camera away, you know, literally 2 or 3 feet away from me doing it with my guitar on the, you know, the whammy bar, the way it was set up. And it was just amazing. And then sure enough, you know, so I knew Jeff a little bit, and then he came to a few of the band shows and whatnot. And then I kind of went out to see him a couple of times when he was playing in LA, and sort of, you know, got to sort of say, hey, you know, hang out after the show a little bit and catch up and whatnot. And then of course Jeff then ended up recommending me for the Tal Wilkenfeld gig, which was crazy. Which it was something that she didn't tell me until a couple of years after I'd had the gig. She was like, oh yeah, by the way, it was Jeff that recommended me. And I was like, what?
Cool.
It was pretty cool. Yeah. Really cool.
What is Jeff like?
What's he like? He's very nice. He's quite fairly shy, but he's cool. Very understated. You know, he's very, very cool.
I've heard he's simple in that way, that he loves cars and guitars.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the fact, you know, I think people, you know, you hear about Jeff and, you know, say he never plays guitar. He's always just playing with his cars, but I think it's probably like an obsession with both, sort of 50-50. And he's still amazing, of course. Actually, he's playing here in Franklin, Tennessee, on the day after I leave, so on like Tuesday or something. So I'm about 30 minutes outside of Nashville in like this small town called Franklin, and bizarrely he's playing here with ZZ Top in like three days, and it'd be like, I haven't seen him in like, a you know, 3 years or so. So it'd be great to go and see him. And he's like just down the road, but I won't be here.
Yeah.
So I'm leaving on tour. I know Jeff a little bit. He's amazing. He was a massive influence on my playing. You know, I think a lot of the time, even when you're not playing in the style of your influence, you still carry that with you. And there's still some of those things that, you know, influence.
Yeah.
And you know what? He's the prime example of, you know, the tone thing. Like his tone is actually varies quite a lot, you know, but it's all, you can always tell it's him, and it's just his way of playing is so like direct. But he's one who will, you know, he'll let notes hang, and he'll, you know, I went to see Alison Krauss and Robert Plant a few nights ago, and there was something. And her voice is just so amazing.
I actually
went to see them about 2 weeks ago, and then coincidentally my tech started working with them on this tour. And I got invited, he invited me to a private a private show, which is about 30 people. Yeah. And it was a taping for the country music television show. And it wasn't in an actual venue. It was in like a, you know, like a staging sort of place. Yeah. And I was probably about sitting about six, I was front row, about 6 feet away from Robert Plant, singing like right in front of me, and Alison Krauss. And her voice is just so pure. And the way she sings is just so direct and so intentional. And those are the sort of, you know, that's exactly how I would describe Jeff Beck's guitar playing. Yeah. His tone is so pure. You know, even if it's like even if he has like load of gain, it's still such a pure tone. And the way he plays is so direct and so intentional.
What kind of elements does that purity, in your opinion, consist of? Like, if you try to describe the style a little bit beyond just the purity, is it like way he, the dynamics obviously make a big part. He's a very dynamic player, but what else?
I mean, he has a very strong connection, like in terms of, I mean, it's going back to what we were saying earlier, it is in the way he attacks the string, you know, it's in his hands, the way he attacks the string. It's a very, you know, he has a very intentional, purposeful way of playing. So, you know, if you attack the string, he's not hitting the string hard, but he's hitting it, you know, he hits the string well. I'm thinking back to like some of my favorite snooker players, the way they hit the ball well. Like to someone who doesn't play snooker, it's just like, well, you just hit it. It's just the same, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's like,
yeah.
And it's the same with guitar playing. It's like, well, how many different ways can there be of hitting the string? But yeah, Jeff just hits the string very well. And it's a combination of that and not being scared just to let the notes breathe and let the notes hang. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's just a strong way of playing, I guess, you know.
You know,
if you were to just play like a simple phrase, like a... You know, it's kind of not, there's no rush, even though obviously, you know, that was crap, whatever. But yeah, it's just a, you know, it's just a very direct. Even the kind of like the light touches, they're very intentional. Vinny Colaiuta and the you know, the one arguably the greatest, one of the greatest drummers of all time.
Indeed.
I got to sit in on a session with him, not playing. He was just playing down the road from me, doing a session with Tal actually. Yeah. And they were like, hey, we're playing down the road, come and hang out. So I got to sit in on this session and I got to sit next to Vinny in the live room and and just watch him play, you know. And his thing is like, you know, whether he's hitting really hard or whether he's just playing really soft, there's so much intention behind everything you play. It's just so powerful. It's like, you know, it's just a mastery. It's just a control thing. It's just, you know.
Yeah. We get back to the idea of intention and idea. Obviously, you have to have the intention and idea of hitting it light or like rough. If you want to play it like angry and dirty, you have to have the idea first that this is how I want to do it, and then you attack the subject.
Well, you know what? I think after a while, the way you play is second nature, because it's just like your voice. It's the way you talk. It's the way you enunciate. So, like, I don't think any of these great players are actually thinking about their way they're attacking the note, stuff like that anymore.
But they have done the work before. They have thought of it, how they want to sound like before.
I don't know. I don't know if they have. I think it's almost the same as it being a... Even back in the day when they were first learning, it's a second nature thing where they turn the knobs on the amp to, it's just an instinctual thing, I think. Like you say they've done the work. I guess it's more they have the experience of being in these yeah, they have the experience of just putting in the hours, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, but another thing I was thinking as well is, there's a difference between having that sort of commitment to your playing. If you're doing, going back to the Stevie Ray Vaughan sort of thing, if you're just doing that same thing, it's easy to commit to something you've played 100 times, you know. You know. You can commit to that and you can play it hard and you can play it strong, you know. But there's a difference between doing that and commit and having the same commitment to something when you're, you know, improvising or if there's some sort of element of, you know, you're not sort of just parroting something you've done a million times before, you know.
Yeah.
And that's that's why guys like Wayne Krantz are so scary. The guys that can like commit to their improvisation like so hard, it's nuts. Just doing this, shredding this, you know, mandolin solo. And it just cracks me up knowing that I live in Nashville, the land of the baddest of the bad mandolin players in the world. And this guy from Essex, England is up here playing with like one of the biggest selling country acts of all time playing mandolin and like, you know, just getting away with it. It's so funny.
Life is kind of crazy.
Kind of crazy, yeah. Again, that was another look behind the curtain, because to the people out in the crowd, they probably just think I'm some redneck who's just been playing this mandolin his whole life.
Yeah.
And it's just one of those things that, you know, things are never as they appear, and anyone can, under the right circumstances, can get there and make it happen, you know?
Yeah.
You know? You don't have to be the best.
So,
go on.
Yeah, but some players that, like we know your early influences with SRV and Jeff and those guys, but who are some of the players that have inspired you the most in LA or Nashville? You talked about Bukovac, obviously, but who else besides Tom?
Well, you know, I always joke that Bukovac is kind of my new sensei, but he's like, his studio craft is just on another level, you know. It's like the last guy that I really felt inspired, the last person that really like pushed me was Tal, that really took me to another level was her. And she was amazing because she would kick my ass, but it was always in a really positive and encouraging way. She just wanted me to get better for me and for her. She just, you know, she just got a real kick out of just trying to get the most out of me. And you know, she would break me down like on things, and I would just, you know, be so a much stronger player from it, you know. So she was the last kind of person before, you know, that really took my playing to another level. Before that, it was Paul Stacey.
Yeah.
When we worked on that record, and he just changed the way I saw guitar by, you know, he never showed me a single thing on guitar. He totally Miyagi'd me. Totally Mr. Miyagi'd me by doing the wax on, wax off. He would like sit me down and he'd make me like, I'd watch like the, you know, like the making of The Exorcist, like the like movies, and, you know, and he'd show me things on YouTube or he'd give me something to read, and it just totally changed the way I played guitar. And then it had been like a while since I'd found anyone. Like LA, there was just, you know, not because I think of myself as a particularly good guitar player by any means, but it just took a while. It, you know, I just didn't really find anyone there that after Tal that really made me think, yeah, I can really learn from, or there's stuff I really want to learn from this person.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I became friends with Bukovac, and it was just like, you know, really just like his craft. There's just so much I know I can learn from that guy. Like right now, there's no really real immediate focus on improving anything on my guitar playing rather than just trying to sort of, you know, because I've been out, you know, I haven't been playing a lot. I just want to kind of get fitness, you know, stamina back.
Yeah.
I would like to, you know, get back to being, you know, sort of more of a badass player that I was sort of like, you know, 8 years ago or so. But my priorities have changed, you know.
Yeah.
Now I'm kind of, you know, more of a sort of utility guy. And I'm not necessarily even listening to guitar players for inspiration or stuff like that. But certainly someone who I'd like to spend more time with and around would be Tom for sure.
Yeah.
Just
yeah.
because, you know, we've all seen his videos and, you know, he picks up a guitar and he plays something. And whenever he plays, it's like you're listening to, it's like you imagine he's done 10 takes of something and you're listening to the take, you know? And that's what it's like. If you're in even just in a room with him and he picks the guitar up and it's just like perfect intonation, perfect tone. And even if he's improvising, it's just like, it's just there. And that's just something so rare. And, you know, it's totally, and it's just totally not the, it's not the showboating thing. And it's totally just not the thing you strive to do for so many years is, you know, it's like almost the opposite because like, you know, as a kid, you sit down to like play something that's way harder than you can do.
Yeah.
And if you can play it one time in 20 and do it well, then you're happy. But like this, it's kind of like the opposite of that. It's just playing like basic stuff perfectly.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I guess the opposite of that would be playing basic stuff really badly, but so it's not the opposite. But.
And there's plenty of guys around him too. Recently listened a lot for like, well, the last couple of years, but now his friend Jed Hughes.
Yeah, he's so good.
He's so good. The touch, the like the Mark Knopfler thing, like combined with the Nashville kind of aesthetic, he's so good. A bit like Tom in some ways.
But, yeah, well, but, you know why? It's because when you're around someone like Tom, it just elevates you. Do you know what I mean? That's kind of why my guitar playing got to a sort of not an ability level, but it's why I got in the right mindset to be able to sort of like take gigs and be able to like kick their ass. It's because of the people who I've been around and they kind of, you know, they and people that make you comfortable being at that level, you know, that what you do is enough and all you have to do is turn up and do what you do and kick its ass. Do you know what I mean?
So
being around those guys makes you, you know, like I think I said before, it's like, you know, they say if just being around someone who's a saint makes you a better person. It's like being around someone like Bukovac will instantly make you a better guitar player.
Yeah.
Not by showing you something, but just by making you reassess what is actually important. You know?
Yes, that's so good. That's a good line. So let's go into gear and your tonal preferences.
Okay.
Talking about tone earlier, but now what's sort of the home base for you sound wise? What like let's say what amplifier type, like Fender, Vox, Marshall, whatever, and then maybe what kind of guitar?
I guess kind of historically I've been into anything that's based on like a Fender Bassman.
I like
amps with headroom. I like amps with headroom because I don't like to run them especially dirty. You know, I like to run them. I like to be able to hit them hard with, you know, an overdrive or something and not have them fold. You know, it's funny because I have the things that I like, but then I have the things that I know are right and appropriate for what I'm doing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So what might be appropriate for something would be like the absolute last thing I would choose for myself on a gig, which might be like a Les Paul straight into a JCM 800 or something like that, or with a Rat or something like that, you know, an Awar, you know. But I know that might be appropriate if I'm trying to do like a like an Izzy Stradlin part or something like that, you know.
Yeah.
Something like a sound like part. But yeah, for myself, what I'm most comfortable with is, you know, something that resembles, you know, like a Marshall Plexi or a Bassman.
Yeah.
No, I like 6v6 tubes. I'm not a big fan of 10-inch speakers, even though I say the Bassman thing. So like, you know, probably, as you know, my main amp has been that Victoria Golden Melody, which is like a 212 Fender bassman. But yeah, I like stuff that has headroom, doesn't have to have reverb. And then, you know, I like a couple of different types of dirt. I'm big into the tube overdrives, ones that have like a 12AX7, like the BK Butler overdrives. Those will be tend to what I'll use for lead tone stuff. Again, just depending on the genre or whatever. But if I'm just sitting around and it's my, you know, noodling, and it's my own time, then yeah. Some sort of 12AX7 overdrive, you know, sometimes a delay, sometimes a vibe. I nearly always have the Flint on my board because that's, you know,
yeah.
Not only is that kind of like this, you know, a session man's Swiss Army knife of sounds in there, it's actually totally me as well, you know, yeah. The sounds.
Yeah.
You know, a boost. I use the Vertex boost is something that I always use in all of my boards now.
Yeah.
Because as you know, I'm big into like fuzz pedals. So I don't ever use like an input buffer because it screws with that. Yeah, so I typically always have my first buffer in my pedal board after my overdrives and before my delay, my sort of modulations and delays, which is also where I have my volume pedal. So I really like the sound of the Vertex boost turned off because of the bypass. The buffer is the most natural sounding buffer I've found, and it's great. But also the hack where you can plug in the, you know, the volume pedal and use that as a controller is great. So that's always on my board. You know, as I've kind of grown older, I've kind of gotten more and more into delays and stuff like that. You know, I never used to use a delay back in the day, I guess because I was, you know, as I said earlier, I was the annoying Stevie Ray kid. So, you know, I was using 3 amps. I was using like a Leslie cabinet, using a Tube Screamer, a Wah, an Octavia.
Yeah,
delay never occurred to me to use that, you know. But you know, the delay is an essential if you get into the Jeff Beck thing. You know, it's you like the delay. I like to have a slap delay. I like to have a long delay. For the last few years, I've been using the rehoused the Ibanez Echo Machine. You know, the EM5 whatever, which is amazing. But I've recently gone back to my old Boss RE20 Space Echo, which is so good, such an underrated pedal. So yeah, typically, you know, a couple of overdrives, a fuzz, a vibe, delay, and the Flint, and I'm good, you know?
Yeah.
And then guitars. It's funny because, yeah, again, growing up, I was always a Strat guy, went through the whole Stevie Ray thing. And then when I got into the doing the Purple Melon thing, Tom, his guitar was of course a Jeff Beck signature Strat. Tom was this lead singer, and the other guitarist was a like a serial number 4 prototype that Jeff had given him. So I was like, well, we can't both play Strats in the band because, you know, that just doesn't work, you know. So I went the SG route and I became an SG guy for a while, and played SGs, played a Guild S100, which was their version of the SG, which I absolutely loved. And it was great for my playing, you know, it was great to get away from the whammy-age for a while, getting a hard tail. But yeah, so, and then I went back to Strats when the band ended and I could go back to just, you know, I was teaching at MI, went back to Strats. But then in recent years, I've just become a total Tele guy, you know. Total Tele guy, because, you know, I have a couple of my own build OTB Teles, and they're just great, you know. I always say that my guitars are perfect for me.
Yeah.
And, you know, and other people play them and they, you know, have loved them, and I build them for them exactly how I wouldn't know how to build it in any other way than what I like, you know. It would just be a guess if the other person was going to like it. So all the guitars I build for customers, I build them exactly the same as I build for me.
Yeah.
You know, and it's kind of, you know, it's 30 years of going down the rabbit hole that goes into my guitars from, you know, from the headstock to the end of the body. The whole guitar has just like been way too much overthinking, but they're exactly right. I actually have a signature pickup set coming out with, JW Restoration, a Tele pickup set.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, actually, he does a Philips Ace a Philip Sace signature set, and I just saw someone bought a set and was selling them on Reverb for something insane, like $10,000 or something like that, something crazy. But yeah, if you don't know JW Restoration, his pickups, he's a luthier repair guy, does amazing work on guitars, but his pickups are just incredible. Yeah. And they're getting more and more expensive by the minute, so get in there and get them. So yeah, him and I talked about doing a Strat set for ages, because as you know, I'm a Strat guy. And actually the bridge pickup in this guitar, which you've heard me using, is actually one of his pickups, and it's a Broadcaster pickup.
Yeah.
So it's essentially like a, you know, a Tele twang pickup. But it just kind of, you know, it's, for me, it's the ultimate solution to that problem of the Strat bridge pickup being way too thin, but not wanting to go full humbucker. As you know, for a while I had the Firebird mini humbucker in there for a while, which you've probably seen on Matthias Asato's most recent signature Sur guitar.
Yeah.
And that, with no coincidence, I'm sure. But I've seen that configuration start to pop up in a few places now, which is kind of cool. But yeah, I've since moved on to this, which we may do a Strat set, which has been a total game changer, because, you know, it kind of, in the context, it's still kind of, you know, neck pickup, middle pickup, and then bridge pickup. You wouldn't say, hey, that's a Tele, that's a Broadcaster, but it still works in context with the other pickups.
Yeah.
But it just means I can do like the rockier stuff with it, and, you know. But yeah, so I've gravitated more towards Teles anyway, long story short. And that's probably where I feel most at home and most me, I guess, even though I don't really know who me is on the guitar, to be honest, you know. Yeah. But you know what? It's funny. I guess me is who is whatever I'm doing at the time on that session. You know, I don't really think about it when I'm not playing, or try and become something.
Yeah.
Just try and broaden my ears. I went to see Robert Plant the other day, and one of his guys was playing like guitar, banjo, mandolin, and he was just the most ridiculous, I think his name was Stuart Duncan, the most ridiculous violin player. And he was playing some of this Indian classical style language, which I don't, you know, Tal actually got me big into that, and you know, and it was obviously, you know, a big influence on like some of Derek Truck's slide playing was the Indian classical stuff.
Yeah.
But it was some of the language he was playing was just so good. And I feel like kind of getting away from anything guitar-y is cool, is the way.
Yeah. And you yourself you're also a great slide player. Do you have a slide over there now? Could you play a bit?
Well, I'm in standard tune, but you know, I've no problem with playing in standard tune slide. It's kind of like, it depends if you get called for a session and they want you to do like the Elmore James. All that stuff is obviously in like an open tuning.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But when I play slide, I never really play the sort of the traditional language stuff. This is on a Strat, by the way, the low action. But yeah, the cool thing about the slide is you can kind of do some of that sort of sitar-y. The stuff that's more interesting to me is just kind of experimenting and with, you know, microtone stuff. It's great to be able to do all the, you know, if you get called to do like a Luke Combs sort of country thing or whatever, it's great to be able to do that stuff and know that language. But for me, most of the slide playing, yeah, I that very first guitar I got, what I mentioned earlier, when I was 5, I'd just play slide on it. And then I'd never really ever played slide on a gig until Purple Melon until I moved to the States. Yeah. And now it's like, I'd say like 9 times out of 10 on a session, I end up playing slide now. And it's kind of, I'd say it's maybe one of the things I'm known for, even though I'm not like a, you know, there's some crazy good slide players out there. Yeah, it's kind of, you know, I guess it's just one of the things I do now is slide. Yeah, I dig it.
What? What are some other aspects that are like you? What would you, if I had to describe your playing, I'd say it's a kind of alternative vibe in it.
Right.
With the kind of also legato, I guess it's Holdsworthian stuff that's influenced that.
Wow. Well, that's a compliment.
A bit.
That, what, you're, something... what you're saying is I'm the new and improved Tom Quayle.
Yeah.
in my dreams. You know what? I hung out with Tom. He was out here in Tennessee last month. And the dude is, first of all, such an awesome dude and just an absolute monster. And you know, when I see guys like that, I mean, it's laughable to think that anyone would think I have any sort of ounce of Alan Holdsworth in my playing, but I certainly, you know.
But you know,
we'll take the compliment for sure.
But it's a kind of combination of rock and kind of quirkiness. You know, right. Jeff has the same thing.
Yeah.
That bit of a curveball every time you hear. You don't know what you're kind of getting.
One of the best things, again, going back to Tal, is that she gave me so much freedom. You know, we'd play her songs, and obviously you'd have to play the songs, but she would give me so much freedom to kind of go out there and sort of, I could mess up and, you know, she, the last thing she wanted was me to be playing Jeff Beck sound alike stuff or to be playing cliche guitar licks, or the last thing she wanted me to be doing was giving the audience exactly what they wanted, which is, you know, a bunch of dudes that were there to hear who's this guy who's trying to, you know, play guitar with someone that used to play with Jeff Beck, which was kind of, at first was somewhat frustrating because I just wanted to show them that, you know, I can do what they want. And it's, you know, it was kind of a cool platform for me because it's like, oh, who is this guy playing with her? He must be, you know, able to play. But it was kind of like then sort of, you know, not having to dumb it down at all, but it was just having to come at it from a completely different angle. Yeah. It was just all about communication, and I could get as weird as I wanted. And it was, and it was one of the best things that's happened to my playing was her making me not think guitar and just playing in the moment, even if it's terrible, just playing what you want to play in the moment, you know? So it's cool to not, you know, it's cool to get weird. You know, I wish I could actually force myself to get weirder. You know, I wish I could break away from that language even more. But there becomes a certain point, I guess, where you have to keep in touch with what's, you know, you can toe the, if I want to keep doing what I'm doing as a session guy, you have to toe the line both sides, you know?
Yeah.
And I think maybe that is my biggest strength, perhaps, is that I kind of can toe the line of a lot of things quite convincingly, you know?
Yeah. Any last words? What would you like
later,
to say?
Fine.
Where can people find you? You're on Instagram, obviously.
I'm on Instagram, but it's, you know, I don't post content. Just come to a gig. I'll be in Europe with the chicks next year. And, I would much rather people come and see me playing as part of an ensemble doing something really musical and great than be like, hey, I'm playing the baked potato. Come and see me. Do you know what I mean? It's like...
Yeah.
No, I mean,
I get the idea.
I'd much rather be part of something bigger and like be, you know, that was the takeaway from the Robert Plant thing, is that his band were just like listening to each other so intently and they were just all so restrained. But like when they got a chance to do stuff, it was so appropriate and so tasty, but so like not boring either. Oh, here comes my dog. Yeah. But yeah, I don't know what the takeaway. I feel like I've just been doing a lot of waffling on and not much playing, and and the playing I have done has been subpar, but that's just where it, that's just how it was today.
Yeah.
Hopefully the people listening to this already know who I am and know I can actually play though, so sometimes. Sometimes
they'll know you here in Finland after this.
Sure. Yeah, well, after this next tour, I'm just going to be known as Owen Barry, the mandolin player. But you know what? Because you know, for me, it's the same. It's all the same thing. It's just all the same thing. Yeah. You know,
it's music.
It's music. Yeah, and that's way cooler than. I think I've said this to you before as well. Being a guitar player isn't cool. It's like probably the most embarrassing, tragic instrument to play because the nature of guitarists and what being a guitarist implies about you, sort of thing almost. You know, that is why mandolin is so much fun for me, because it's such a emasculating instrument that it's about nothing other than music and fun, you know. Music and communication, and that's kind of why, you know, that's why I first started playing guitar in the first place. It wasn't to be cool, or it was just something, it was all about the activity itself and nothing more.
And I think this is a good place to end the show and call it next time the mandolin pod.
Exactly. I was trying to make a Star Wars joke there. Mandalorian. No. I'll have the joke ready for next time.
Well, thank you, Owen, so much. It was an honor and pleasure to have you as a guest on
the podcast. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.